We have a country which is really in an affordable housing crisis right now.
With lower mortgage rates and that low supply, we're going to continue to see these prices move higher yet again.
We have underbuilt for the last decade since the end of the recession to the tunes of millions of homes.
Today, we begin a bold new initiative to bring down the cost of housing for American families.
It's not for the federal government to come here to Greenville and say build this or build that. It's for the federal government to come in and say, what's your plan and how can we be a good partner in that?
Millions of Americans are in crisis, and I believe in the United States of America, every American should have access to safe, affordable housing.
The single-family home, with or without picket fence, is not just the culmination of the American dream. It's all but mandated by law. On 75% of the residential property in the United States, it's illegal to build anything else. That's been increasingly true for almost 100 years, reinforced by federal programs and the homeowner's tax deduction. But now, even as the rate of home ownership is on the rise, a radical shift is underway in Minnesota. In Oregon, even in California, there's a move toward increased density in residential neighborhoods. The crisis in affordable housing and climate change have combined to make the issue part of next year's presidential campaign. Emily Badger covers cities and urban policy for The Upshot at the New York Times. Emily, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to President Trump and the Democrats, you've got some very interesting history about the concept of single-family housing. Started out with the idea that a house is not a home unless you can drive a yoke of oxen around it. Where did that phrase come from?
So this is a very, very old concept, you know, going back to the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, that we prize not only single-family homes, but neighborhoods full of single-family homes. So this idea suggests that, you know, not only should everyone have kind of that home with a yard and a picket fence, but if apartment buildings or denser housing start to encroach on neighborhoods like that, it will in some ways kind of destroy the quality of life in those communities. Perhaps it will impact the property value in those communities. And so we've taken this idea and we have kind of legally built it into how we design communities all over the country through this concept of single-family zoning.
This includes a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1926.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court, when it legalized zoning of all different kinds, the idea that you can have commercial land over here and residential land over here, it specifically included the notion that you can have land devoted solely to this one kind of housing, detached single-family homes. And the Supreme Court in this 1926 decision sort of voiced this notion that still remains with us today in various forms, which is that apartment buildings, denser housing, act almost like a parasite on single-family neighborhoods, that they are this thing to try to keep at bay, that we should be concerned about encroaching into these communities.
They went on and on, talking about how apartments block the sun and the air, bring noise and traffic. Use the phrase parasite. That comes right out of the decision.
Yeah, and some of that language is fairly similar to the debates that we hear in communities today, almost 100 years later, when we're talking about whether or not we should make these neighborhoods denser. Communities are very concerned about whether or not bringing more density will contribute to traffic, will make it harder to find parking, whether it will shade people's backyards, whether it will kind of uproot trees and parks and things that people really care about in their communities. So in some way, we're having a conversation in a lot of communities around the country today that is not so dissimilar from the conversations we were having in the 1920s.
Emily Badger, once again with the New York Times. Joel Kotkin is with us. He's a presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in Southern California. He's executive director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism in Houston. His eight books include The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. Joel Kotkin, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
So your writing and your conversation about this from time to time sound like that 1926 Supreme Court decision.
Well, first of all, I think there's some truth to it. I don't think high-density housing is a parasite. But the bottom line is I think we should have choices. And one of those choices is single family. That's what most people want. I think we can do it better than we have done it in the past. And I think there's plenty of room for multifamily. Our cities have huge amounts of open land, including Los Angeles, Dallas, and Chicago 3 that I've studied. And there are many opportunities to build housing particularly with all the redundant retail that we're beginning to see and we're going to see a lot more of. So there are many options to building multifamily housing outside of going into people's neighborhoods And by the way, when you understand what was happening with, let's say, with this SB 50, the Wiener bill, which, you know, the media generally liked, a lot of that opposition was from lower and medium density communities like parts of East L.A., parts of South L.A. I mean, fundamentally, I think people, you know, who live in single-family neighborhoods don't want to see, let's say, a six-story apartment building next door. And I think they have legitimate reasons, particularly if you have kids, particularly if you have, you know, you spent your money, you made this choice, and now somebody's saying, well, no, that choice doesn't work anymore. Well, that's a little bit difficult. You know, and by the way, there's also this discussion, well, single-family homes are racist because most single-family home neighborhoods have been, you know, particularly in the past, you know, were segregated. But today, where are minorities moving? If they can, they move to the suburbs, whether they're Asians, Hispanics, or African-Americans. And actually, the majority of all those populations now live in suburban single-family neighborhoods. So, you know, this, I think what we have to have is choice. That has to be, and the big reason why prices in some places, particularly California, are so high is we have made it very, very difficult to build anything on the periphery. That's usually how we've been able to keep prices down. And when you have urban containment and you basically say, no, you can't build here and you can't build here, you can't build there, the price of land goes up and that makes everything more expensive.
I want to go back to Emily Badger quickly. Joel mentioned SB 50 in Sacramento by Senator Wiener of San Francisco. What's that about and how does it represent the changes that some people, at least, not Joel Kotkin, but others want to see happen?
So what that bill was proposing was that many parts of California would be upzoned. There would be more density allowed, particularly around transit hubs, because there's this notion that, you know, we want more people to be able to access transit. The communities immediately around transit are the most obvious places to allow more density. But it also would have mandated that communities allow more density in very job-rich centers. So if you have a lot of jobs in this community, you can't make it impossible to build new housing for more people to access those jobs. But one of the other things that that bill would have done that was sort of a less central and remarked upon component of it was that it would have said that, you know, single-family lots within single-family zone neighborhoods could be retrofitted over time to have up to four units in them. So if you owned a home in a single-family neighborhood, you know, you could turn your basement into another unit. You know, you could subdivide your property into multiple units. So in that sense, there was a provision in there that effectively would have ended or significantly changed single-family zoning in much of the state of California. This was a number of really dramatic changes all bundled into one bill that was deeply controversial. And it was blocked during this current legislative session in California, but that's not likely the end we're going to hear about it.
Joel Kotkin, what about rezoning in order to allow four units ultimately on a house that's now zoned for just one family home? What's wrong with that?
Well, okay. I mean, what it would do is obviously it would make things much more crowded. I mean, I've seen this happen in where I used to live. But the bottom line is I think there are so many places where we can build housing without going into neighborhoods and changing their character dramatically. And that's what I find so astounding is on the periphery, there's a lot of open land. I mean, you can drive in parts of L.A. and Chicago and Dallas, and there's just empty lots where you could build all sorts of different kinds of housing. I mean, there are many, many places where we can build this stuff without going into people's neighborhoods. You know, neighborhoods are sort of unique. And one of the things about, let's say, like where I live now in Orange County, is everybody in my little cul-de-sac, and you can make fun of that too, is somebody who owns their home and has been here for a long time. We're the newest neighbors. There's a sense of community that's very strong, and you see this a lot when I've done interviews in places like East L.A., where there many of the people are still owners, they've been there for a long time. And look, you have to allow for change, but there are places we can do it where we don't have to uproot an entire community and change its nature in a very dramatic fashion. And again, there's lots of places we can build on the periphery, in the cities, and also in the redundant retail, which I think is the great opportunity for housing in the next 10 years.
All right. Let me introduce Jenny Schutz. She is a fellow in urban policy at the Brookings Institution. She studies and writes about housing policy and land use regulation and neighborhood change, all things we're talking about today. And Jenny Schutz, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
With so much emphasis, as there has been over the years, all the way back to that 1926 Supreme Court decision, all that emphasis on home ownership, what does it mean for renters?
Well, we've essentially stacked the deck against renters, both through our land use policy and through our federal tax policy. And I think you can hear some of the language that Joel is using that gets at why we have done this or what the conversation is that justifies the subsidies that we're providing to homeowners. It's this idea that you have to be living in a community for a long time in order to form a sense of community, that somehow homeowners have deeper connections or are likely to be better neighbors than renters. So we have this sort of pervasive sense that homeownership is somehow changes the nature of people, changes the nature of neighborhoods and communities, and then we've built policies that effectively stack the deck in favor of homeowners and against renters.
So what does that mean for the renters, and what's being proposed to do something about that without, as Joel suggests, destroying the nature of the neighborhoods, or is that possible?
Well, effectively, we've made it hard for renters to live in a lot of the most desirable communities. So renters tend to be younger, they tend to live in cities, they tend to be more heavily non-white than homeowners, and we've made it hard for people to get access to a lot of the places that are close to jobs, close to transportation infrastructure, that have good schools and safe streets, the amenities that both renters and homeowners want. But many of those are effectively quarantined into these single-family neighborhoods. If you don't have enough money to buy or rent a large, expensive house, a single-family house that's detached from its neighbors, you're cut out of all of the amenities and all of the economic opportunity that those neighborhoods provide.
Elaborate a little bit more, if you will, on what you referred to as subsidies for homeowners.
Sure. So the most obvious is that we've built into the federal tax code provisions for homeownership. So if you own a house and you've taken out a mortgage to buy it, you get to deduct the interest that you pay on that mortgage from your federal income taxes. So that can be a fairly substantial benefit that homeowners get and a renter in the exact same house would not get. There are some other provisions in the tax code. For instance, when you sell your house after having owned it for a while, you get to keep a lot of the capital gains from that house without paying taxes. That's a big distinction from, say, keeping your retirement funds in a 401k or in some sort of other financial asset. When you sell your stocks, you have to pay capital gains on the full amount. So we've not just created these incentives for homeownership relative to renters, we're also incentivizing households to do essentially all of their wealth building and savings through their home, which is actually not a great strategy financially because it's not diversified.
So Joel Kotkin, what do you say to that? Is that fair to renters in the first place? And then we're just beginning a new topic here. What about home ownership as an investment? Is it really too risky?
Well, there's a lot of literature on all different sides. I mean, the key thing to me is that when you have a situation where people, own homes, I'm looking at this historically. I'm writing a book about our return to feudalism, so I'm not happy about what's happening out there. But I think what you have is when you have dispersed property ownership, that's kind of a big part of what has made democratic societies work, pretty much everywhere. If you get a concentration of ownership, which is what you will get, because what will happen is that, let's just say you say, okay, we're going to incentivize the building of new apartments in single-family neighborhoods. What are you going to get? You're not going to get family 3-4-bedroom houses, apartments. Nobody builds those pretty much anymore. They basically build studio and one bedroom for, mostly for single people, generally, younger people, and they also tend to be very expensive because it's very expensive to build. So I think that there are other ways to, to deal with the housing problem without taking away the incentive for people to own homes. I mean, it's been at the very, very core, particularly of the United States, that people own homes and that they have, they have a stake in their neighborhood, they have a stake in the country, they have, the renters have a different relationship because most renters, about 80% of them, would like to be homeowners. So, as long as we can keep that aspiration there, I think it's okay. But I think that the idea that we want to have a country where basically the land is owned by Wall Street, which is what would happen, I think is profoundly anti-democratic, and also I think something that really undermines the very ethos of the country.
Well, we already have land owned by Wall Street, don't we? Because we have mortgages. What's the difference between that and what you're suggesting?
Well, because if you have a mortgage, you still own the house and you still make a profit theoretically. Well, I don't know. I mean, I've made money on every house I've owned, so I'm pretty happy with it. On the other hand, if you're a renter, you're just sending money to somebody on Wall Street who probably has more money than he knows what to do with anyway.
Well, let me go back to Emily Badger. What about the concern now about climate change? And we talk about the suburbs particularly. Questions are being raised, and I think that's part of what you refer to as the major change we're undergoing, about the sustainability of the suburbs when you have to have commuting. That's particularly true in major metropolitan areas like Los Angeles.
So the point that Joel raised earlier, that there is plenty of land left to develop on the periphery, is precisely the thing that people who are making an environmental argument about density say is the problem. They argue that, you know, single-family zoning and sort of our refusal to build more dense housing means that, you know, we're just encouraging sprawl. We're going to develop suburbs that are going farther and farther out over time, and that's going to encourage people to take these really long car commutes and exacerbate auto emissions that come from them. So there's this particular argument that suggests that, you know, one of the solutions to climate change that we should be thinking about now is how to build denser cities so that people are living with sort of a smaller carbon footprint, so that you're not creating as many greenhouse gas emissions by your commuting every day, so that more people can live near transit. And, you know, so there's a fairly strong camp of people who are advocating for denser housing who are doing it particularly with the environmental argument. But obviously, as Joel has articulated, you know, there are certainly people who would push back against that as well.
So, Jenny Schutz, back to you at the Brookings Institution. This now has found its way into the presidential campaign, this argument between that we're hearing now between Joel Kotkin and others about what, in fact, is the best way to solve the housing crisis. We certainly do have one in terms of affordability and perhaps also in terms of climate change. What are the presidential candidates proposing?
There are three candidates who've put forward some pretty comprehensive housing plans that deal with both some of the demand side issues and the supply side issue, which is essentially what we're talking about here with single family zoning. So there, you can think of this as sort of two different affordability problems. One is that there are a bunch of people who simply can't afford market rate housing. That's included poor people for a long time, but is increasingly including lower middle income households. And so the several of the candidates, in particular Warren, Booker, and Castro, have some proposals to give subsidies particularly towards renters at both the low end of the income distribution and sort of the lower middle part. Those three also have proposed using federal influence a little bit more directly to try to counteract single-family zoning or try to change the incentives for local governments to develop zoning that's more density-friendly and that encourages greater diversity of housing stock. There are a limit to the number of tools that the federal government has directly to get involved because land use is essentially a local issue. But there are a couple of different levers that you can press on, one of which is trying to create some financial carrots and sticks to change local government's behavior.
Joel Kotkin, I think you need to leave us. And I want to ask you one question, though, before you go and we go to a break. Then we'll come back and talk more with Jenny Schutz and Emily Badger. But you say you're writing a book called The Return to Feudalism. Does this fit into your theory?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's something that is something that in doing the history on this, I found that one of the reasons that you started to see the development of democracy was that the opening up of land ownership, and that when you constrict land ownership, it goes the other direction. And one of the characteristics of feudalism was land was owned by a relatively small number of people, and most people were just, you know, essentially renters. And I would not like to see that. I would like to see home ownership expand over time and to become something that at least people have the aspiration to achieve. So that's, but you'll be hearing more about feudalism soon.
Okay, Joel Kotkin, again, thanks for being with us. Once again, he's at Chapman University and also the Opportunity Urbanism Center in Houston. One of his books is The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about the presidential race and this whole idea of home ownership as a tool of democracy. Back in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Ollie back with To The Point, talking now with Emily Badger of the New York Times, Jenny Schutz of the Brookings Institution, and Joel Kotkin raised an interesting question about whether opening land to ownership is in fact important to democracy. Jenny Schutz, I'm interested in your take on that.
So I actually think that there's an assumption we need to go back and question, which is whether ownership of a house is necessarily the same thing as the structure type of the house. So Joel is talking very much about ownership of a single family house that's attached to a piece of land, but that's actually a little bit of an outdated view of what homeownership can be. As we see more people wanting to live close to work and close to urban amenities, that doesn't necessarily mean that people don't want to own a space, but we don't have to think about homes as just being a single-family house with a yard and white picket fence. You know, the condo is essentially the new starter home. It gives people a chance to have stability and predictability of their housing payments while still having a small space that's someplace close to work and urban amenities.
The City Observatory has an article by Daniel Hertz saying that, in fact, you can't promote home ownership as an investment strategy and have housing be affordable at the same time. Take that one on.
Sure. I think the problem is that if people buy homes expecting that they're going to gain in value, then you have to be able to sell your house to somebody else at a higher price down the road, right? So if housing is primarily an investment strategy that's intended to appreciate over time, then necessarily housing prices have to be going up over time. That raises the question of, well, who's going to be able to buy the more expensive house at some point in the future to realize those capital gains? And that's where we run into problems with affordability and accessibility of people getting into the market at the beginning. That said, it's not true historically that housing has always increased in value greater than the rate of inflation. We've certainly seen some time periods and some local markets where housing rises very rapidly in value. But over sort of the broader scope of geography and over the long period of time, if housing rises more or less at the rate of inflation or something similar to, say, just a broad index of the stock market, then it can be both affordable for people to become homeowners for the first time and people are able to develop some wealth, but they don't become fabulously rich from owning a house.
Okay. Emily Badger, back to you at the upshot at the New York Times. This argument is developing into a major battle, it seems to me, between the NIMBYs and the YIMBYs, the not in my backyards and the yes in my backyards. This is the first time we've really heard about YIMBYs. Tell us about them and who are they and what exactly are they advocating?
So YIMBYs are people, they've obviously sort of framed themselves in opposition to the not in my backyard type, but specifically what they are advocating for is bottom line, more housing. We should be building more housing. You know, that may be, housing that's built by the private market that would be available at kind of market prices. But a lot of them are also advocating for more affordable housing that would be built, for example, by nonprofit developers. But the idea is basically that there are many communities, particularly on the coasts in the United States, where there is fundamentally a housing shortage. Communities have not built enough over decades in order to keep pace with the population growth that they've had. And, you know, these groups are saying, we need to build more housing. We need to change policies that make it possible to build more housing. So that includes advocating, you know, changing the kinds of zoning laws that we've been talking about. It includes, you know, changing all of these sort of very minute little processes that a developer has to go through in order to build a new housing. So, you know, does it make sense that it would take 12 months, 24 months for a developer to get a permit to build a new apartment building. You know, should we shorten that? Should we, do everything that we can to make it easier to build the type of kind of transit-oriented development that a lot of communities are saying they would like to have? So, you know, this group is a little bit new and novel in part, I think, because the housing crisis is increasingly touching the middle class. It's increasingly touching young professionals who have pretty good jobs, who feel like they ought to be able to afford an apartment, but they're still not able to in a lot of very high-cost cities. And so they've increasingly become attuned to the fact that, you know, housing is a big political problem in their cities, and this is the thing that this group of people has chosen to fight about.
So it's touching the middle class, especially, as you suggest, in the coastal regions. Jenny Schutz, is this also true in other parts of the country? And if it's not, does that make it very risky for presidential candidates to start talking about it?
The limits on housing supply and the affordability at the middle of the income distribution is still mostly a problem of the big coastal metros. That said, there are a lot of people who live in those big coastal metros, so a substantial number of Americans are affected by this. If you look at cities in the middle of the country, so the Chicago's, the St. Louis, Cleveland, those are places where housing is still pretty affordable for sort of a middle-income household, but their lower-income households and even people in sort of the lower middle class are feeling affordability pinches just because incomes haven't been keeping up with the costs of building homes and the cost of maintaining and running apartments.
So does this get back to this issue of the riskiness of the investment strategy of home ownership in the first place?
Homeownership hasn't been a windfall gain for people who live in the middle part of the country. People have been able maybe to pay off their mortgage and accumulate some forced savings. But if you talk to somebody who bought a house in, say, the city of St. Louis 30 years ago, they have not become a millionaire just by sitting on the house. That's part of the issue that we're running into with sort of how fair is it that some people have essentially bought into communities where the land value appreciated. They didn't do anything. They just owned a house. They bought at the right time in the right place and became very wealthy. And they've now shut down development so that the next generation can't buy a house at all, can't afford a place to live in order for some people to protect their investments.
You've written that this is not only a problem of the lack of housing, but also a question of stifled wages. That really broadens the argument in a big way.
In particular, this is a problem for the bottom 20 to 25% of the income distribution, that incomes really just haven't been keeping up with the basic cost of housing. And so there's a substantial gap between what a family can afford to pay each month and what it costs for a landlord to maintain even a pretty modest quality existing apartment. So that income gap is really not a problem of supply. The way to fix that is essentially to give poor people more money, either through something like housing vouchers or the earned income tax credit, but basically just give people more money so that they can afford a decent place to live.
Emily Badger, is that something that could happen at the local or state level, or is that really a federal issue?
Well, there is something sort of related to this idea that Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Julian Castro have all proposed, which is that we should have some kind of refundable tax credit for renters that would specifically help people who are paying more than 30% of their income on rent. That's the level at which economists have generally said if you're paying more than that, you know, we're starting to get into a red zone where that's unsustainable. And so what they have proposed is that, you know, the federal government should in some sense basically be sending you a check, perhaps even on a monthly basis, to help you cover the cost of rent. And, you know, there are various reasons why, some people would have concerns about this. Perhaps that's money that really just gets passed through at the end of the day to landlords. But what those candidates are talking about is something similar to what Jenny has discussed, where literally we're talking about putting money in the pockets of people in order to help them cover their rent.
Now, that's something that goes back all the way to the Nixon administration, the idea that we may need some kind of guaranteed federal income. Jenny Schutz, have any of the candidates gone that far?
So the mainstream candidates haven't embraced something like a universal basic income. They're mostly talking about targeted income supports for people who earn usually below some amount of money. The level at which they would target the programs does vary a little bit. So Kamala Harris, for instance, is proposing that this renter tax credit cover households earning up to potentially $100,000 or $120,000 in expensive cities. That's obviously a much broader swath of households than are getting housing subsidies currently. And I think that does raise some questions both about how much money we're willing to spend on this and about who we think really needs help the most.
So let me ask you both the same question. And Emily Badger, let me start with you. How does this issue fall by comparison to traditional political lines that we're all accustomed to over the years?
Well, I mean, we really seldom ever hear serious conversations about housing in presidential elections. And, you know, that's because we have long thought about housing as something that should be worked out at the local level. You know, it's up to your city to decide what its zoning laws are. You know, it's up to your local public housing authority to decide how it allocates its voucher program, for instance. And for the most part, up until very recently, as we were just discussing, housing is not a problem that has really affected middle-class voters. And so we don't hear politicians talking about it. But all of that is starting to change because these pressures are rising in lots of different cities, because the particular candidates who we're looking at this year happen to come from some of the most expensive parts of the country. You know, because one of these candidates, Julian Castro, is a former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. So in that sense, the politics are changing. But sort of historically, you know, this really isn't something that we talk about in a presidential election year on the national stage.
So Jenny Schutz, is this, well, let me just open it up to you, and as I did to Emily Badger, and ask you to just address that issue.
This is a historic amount of interest in housing as a national issue. And I think Emily's exactly right. It's touching on more people. It's touching on some key Democratic constituencies, younger households in urban areas, and particularly in some of the blue cities and blue states. But I also think that you know, this cuts across the traditional partisan lines. We're seeing interest from the Democrats mostly in order to deal with affordability and speak to sort of kitchen table economic issues. But we've also seen interest in the Republican Party. So the White House just put out an executive order that's establishing a presidential commission to study regulation. For Republicans, this is a reduce the amount of regulation and shrink the role of government, as opposed to particularly motivated by affordability. But this does seem to be one of the very unusual areas where you could get some bipartisan agreement, or at least cutting across different coalitions within each of the parties.
How important is it, once again, a question for both of you, that home ownership is apparently on the rise? Is that going to make this even more important, particularly if the rules about homeownership change in the middle of the campaign? Emily, you first.
Well, I mean, so homeownership rates have slightly gone back up, but they are still at relatively historic lows for very young people who would be first-time homeowners, for African Americans. You know, there are certain constituencies that continue to lag very far behind either homeownership rates they've had in the past or behind the homeownership rates of white households today. So, you know, I think that there's still a lot of communities and a lot of potential voters out there who feel like homeownership is outside of their reach, and sort of suggesting to them that homeownership is the primary means to build wealth in this country. It's the thing that you should aspire to. It's the only thing we're going to talk about in federal housing policy is really just not speaking realistically to those voters at all.
Jenny Schutz?
This fits also into changes in demographics and changes in people's lifestyle and their choices over the course of the life cycle. We've had this model where young people maybe go away to college, they rent an apartment for a little while, but at some point they're going to get married and have kids and they want a house with a yard when they get to that stage, and then they remain in their house essentially indefinitely. That's just not a model that most people are going through at this point. You have a longer period of time where people are pre-marriage, pre-kids, more people choosing not to have kids at all. And there's a longer stage of time when people are older, maybe don't want or can't deal with the maintenance requirements of being an owner of a single family house. So part of this is starting to think through a housing stock that better fits the life cycles that people are really engaging in. People may still want to own a house, single family or otherwise, for some point in their life, but we also want to think about a housing stock that's flexible and that adjusts to people's needs over time, not just that you're a renter until you become a homeowner and you stay a homeowner until you die.
All that we're talking about now is, it seems to me, complex, difficult to understand unless you really sit down and think it through. On the other hand, the idea of owning the home and having it and clutching to it, if you will, is pretty powerful. How does this work, do you think, as a political issue, Jenny Schutz? And is it dangerous for Democrats to do anything that appears to threaten the idea of single-family home ownership, picket fence or not?
I think Emily was right when she pointed out that the Democrats who are out the farthest on pushing for federal intervention and changes in land use are people who are coming from high-cost states. So in California, in Massachusetts, in New Jersey, in the New York metro area, the D.C. metro area, there are really strong battle lines being drawn. If you go to a community meeting, people get very passionate about this on both sides. Young people who would like to be able to afford a nicer place than they're living in now or a nicer neighborhood and can't afford it. People who've been in the neighborhood for a long time who sound very much like Joel Kotkin pushing back, this is my neighborhood, I'm an owner, I get to keep it the way I like. People feel very strongly about this on both sides. I think it's going to be a while before the Democratic Party takes sort of a broad platform stance on this, but it will depend on what happens with the nomination. We see, for instance, that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders haven't come out with plans to address local land use from an affordability standpoint. It's not clear yet where the party's going to wind up. Also within the Republican Party, you have sort of a lot of conservative homeowners who would like to keep neighborhoods the way they are, but then you have this sort of more libertarian faction that looks at this from a regulation standpoint.
And Emily Badger, you said the president has proposed a commission. That's a classic way of gesturing toward an issue without actually suggesting to how you would do anything about it. Do you think that the Republicans are sort of waiting to pounce, depending on who is, in fact, nominated by the Democrats, with the option in mind to really hit hard on this whole idea of the sort of sanctity of the home and the neighborhood?
Well, I think that, you know, I absolutely agree with you that there's not very much that's likely to come out of this commission that's going to mean kind of concrete change on the ground for a lot of people. But one of the things that it will do is that it will allow President Trump in a general election where housing may be an issue, depending on which of these candidates we're talking about, to say, look, I'm worried about this. I'm taking action about this, too. You know, I started this White House commission specifically designed to remove barriers to affordable housing. You know, the White House and Secretary Ben Carson's language about this was that, you know, they're worried about housing that is available for firefighters and teachers and, you know, kind of middle class and working class people who in some ways can be part of the Trump constituency. And so, you know, to the extent that there may be sort of a fight about ideas here, I think the president is sort of setting himself up to be able to say, I'm participating in this conversation too. You know, Democrats are not the only ones who are concerned about housing affordability.
In the meantime, if you do remove the regulations, as the Republicans would like to do, Jenny Schutz, it appears that the only thing that gets built is high-cost housing rather than affordable housing. So that's another really important issue of contention.
It's true that new housing that gets built is more expensive than existing housing. One thing that's worth keeping in mind is that anything that does happen, even if something comes out of the commission or if there's legislation passed in Congress in the short run, the effects on the housing market are going to be very gradual, right? So, you know, the first step would be to change the underlying zoning rules or the underlying federal regulations. Then you set up a new environment where developers can start to build maybe different kinds of housing, hopefully build housing more quickly and more cheaply than they can under the current process. But the housing development process takes a long time, especially in these large metros. So I think people who are terrified that eliminating single-family zoning means that their neighborhood is suddenly going to turn into a neighborhood full of high-rises are vastly overestimating how quickly housing markets could respond.
So, Emily Badger, do you think that we're going to be seeing this issue arise during the debates as the Democrats go forward? Are they really eager to talk about it? Or is it something that they'll wait for the eventual nominee to try to work out with the party?
Well, they've certainly been eager to talk about it on the campaign trail. Elizabeth Warren, for example, you know, sort of regularly brings up unprompted her concerns about the homeownership gap between blacks and whites in America. You know, she's talking about this in Iowa, sort of in her stump speeches, even when there are very few African Americans in her audience. You know, for Cory Booker, talking about the housing market is part of just telling his biographical story about, you know, how his parents were originally denied the opportunity to buy a home because they were African American. So, you know, in some contexts, they are very happy to be talking about this. They don't need to be prompted to talk about it. On the other hand, we heard virtually nothing about all of the stuff that we've been talking about in the first set of Democratic presidential debates last week. And I think that that's more a reflection of the fact that, you know, while these issues are, you know, they're intensely important in fights that are happening in communities all across the country, the cost of housing ranks very high among things that are concerning a lot of voters. You know, there are still so many other things that are kind of ranking even higher than that on the list of things that these Democratic candidates are fighting about right now amongst themselves. So, you know, we're going to hear more about their distinguishing their health care proposals from each other. You know, we're going to hear more about, you know, whether or not they think Trump should be impeached. There are just so many issues on the table right now that whether or not we hear very much about this in the debates, I think may be a product less of, you know, how important this topic is to voters than it is to just, you know, the sheer quantity of problems that are going on right now and things that they have to fight about.
Jenny Schutz, is it also difficult to talk about because a lot of people see it as a very localized issue?
I think that's right. It's not something that most people associate with a national political agenda. I will say that there's one potential opening that I'm certainly going to be listening for if and when there are questions asked in the debates about climate change and the candidates' proposals to deal with that. That's a perfect segue for somebody who wants to discuss land use, and there definitely are people who are pushing on this from an environmental angle, as Emily said earlier. So I could imagine that some of the candidates will use this as a chance to say, we need to think about where we're building housing, whether we're building it in the right place so that we can get more use out of public transit and people are less car dependent. Are we building it in locations that are likely to be around and not be destroyed by natural disasters? So that's one way, in addition to, I think, the racial wealth gap, which is likely to come up in the primary debates.
Okay, an issue that obviously is very basic to human existence, housing, and very localized, very national at the same time. It really has a lot of built-in conflict, and we'll see if it does emerge as a major issue as the campaign goes on. Jenny Schutz, again, is a fellow in urban policy at the Brookings Institute. Emily Badger is with the Upshot at the New York Times. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to Joel Kotkin, our earlier guest as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Warren.
Andrea Brody is on vacation. John Reed produced this edition of To the Point. Chuck Prevetere was our engineer. I'm Warren Olney. Don't forget our To the Point climate change update. We're asking this week, has the time finally come to give up our cars? Join us again wherever you get your podcasts and make us part of your action on social media. Our Twitter handle is @ToThePoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly on email at warren.olney@kcrw.org. Join us again. Thanks for listening.